Hello everyone, my name is Dean and welcome back to the Calgary Journal Recap, where I'll take you through the journal's hottest stories of the last few weeks. For our first story, reporter Saleha Huang talks to Sue Shane Simondo, the creator of a book club called Sue Stockville. Simondo grew up around books as her main source of entertainment. When she came to Canada in 2014, she went to the University of Calgary to pursue a major in international relations while also minoring in English. She noticed the predominant influence Western literature had in her education, not just in her English minor, but even during her time in high school.
It's very strange because I think in Zimbabwe we have a very colonial style education. So there wasn't a lot of difference. You know, I came here and when I decided to take a minor in English, the first course, one of my required courses was Shakespeare. And we studied Shakespeare in high school as well. So it was really just the same in that sense. I think I just started to ask myself questions like, why am I reading Shakespeare? Like, why were we reading Shakespeare in Zimbabwe? And I remember I had this one TA who would shame people for not reading certain texts. Like, he'd be like, oh, you haven't read Kafka, you know, like, you're not serious about English literature. Like, you're not a serious, you know, writer or a serious reader if you haven't read certain books. And I remember being very offended because I was well read, but in books that aren't considered mainstream, that are excluded from the canon.
After realizing the lack of diversity in literature, Simondo created Sue Stockville, a book club centered around the work of Black and people of color authors. A Stockville is a type of informal credit union unique to South Africa. It's a community where members look out for each other and make sure everyone has access to food, money, resources, and support. The name, she hopes, will encourage more inclusivity inside and outside of reading.
I want people to understand that understanding people, being inclusive, is really, you need to learn it. Like, you need to learn to understand people. You can't just assume that you will understand people. And reading is really one of the easiest and most accessible ways to really just bring people into your line of sight.
Sue Stockville started within the walls of her apartment, where a small handful of members met as a physical book club. But after an initially slow start, she shut the physical book club down. Cut to May 25th, 2020. George Floyd's death at the hands of Minneapolis police sparked a summer-long, decades-old catalyst to end systemic racism and end violence against the Black community, all united under a single movement, Black Lives Matter. Not only were there protests around the world, but throughout social media, people would share resources and information about Black creators and entrepreneurs to support them and amplify their voice. Hashtag #AmplifyMelanatedVoices was the one Simondo used to share information about Sue Stockville and gave the book club a needed boost.
I was also paying to keep up my website out of my own pocket. A lot of, you know, I'm purchasing books out of my own pocket. And so I just posted, you know, if you would like to support, you know, an organization in a melanated voice in Calgary, you know, there's Sue Stockville. And so I just put that hashtag and it really just went from there because I'd gotten all this funding and really just all the support. And then I was like, so, you know, I think I'm willing to give this book club thing another try. I'm willing to put in some effort. And because I had the support of the donations, it felt like it didn't feel like I was doing it for free. It felt like something had been given to me and I was now, you know, too much is given, much is expected.
Though a lot of the support she received was out of genuine belief in her work, Simondo thinks it was also partially due to performative allyship.
So I think there's a sort of recklessness and a sort of like, here you go, like, I've done my part, but that's really just the beginning. Like, I feel like just financial donations are really the beginning. And I think sometimes even the financial support does not reflect like real action, you know what I mean? Because I feel like, okay, I'm going to donate money, but what else am I going to do? I'm going to actually try and read the books. I'm going to try and have conversations about this. I'm going to ask questions. Whereas I feel like donating money can really just be an easy way to be like, I've done something.
For her, real action isn't reflected in financial support, but in conversation. It's not enough to chip in a small amount of interest, but through long-term investment and action, true change around the way Black and POC voices will come. Simondo strives to be part of that change through her book club. With new and interesting approaches such as introducing video content, she hopes to truly make a difference in the conversation around inclusivity. Simondo's story is the feature story of the Calgary Journal's November/December print issue. Check out the full story at a designated newsstand across the city or by reading the articles online titled Turning the Page. Our next story comes from reporter Bailey Gingrass Hamilton on the recent spikes in opioid overdoses within the last few months. Between April and June this year, there were around 301 accidental opioid deaths, a near 97% increase compared to the 153 deaths around the same time last year. Over the summer, there was a spike in opioid overdose numbers due to COVID-19 affecting the drug supply and harm reduction resources. The pandemic made Alberta's precarious supply of illegal narcotics even more unpredictable. Border closures have affected the flow of those narcotics, resulting in shortages and an increase in the fillers being used to cut the drug supply. And as winter approaches, those numbers may get worse, resulting in calls for Alberta to take a different approach to solving the province's opioid problem. Kathleen LaRose, the provincial programming coordinator for Alberta Addicts who advocate and educate responsibly, noticed that increase as she and her team are doing their best to help drug users.
Yeah, when COVID-19 started, there was a lot of, it was very stressful because a lot of services shut down until they could figure out what they could do to keep everyone safe. And so in that regard, a lot of people were displaced. We're seeing so many more people. Our numbers of interactions increased about 40% in the first couple months, which was huge. So there was a lot more people outside just trying to figure out what to do. And then there was also a lot of people who were afraid to actually access services, access the shelters, because they didn't want to catch COVID. So that was another thing. So it was either people weren't able to access or people were afraid to access.
Under current conditions, the upcoming holidays may not help drug users either, as LaRose explains.
So when, holiday season, a lot of people, there's naturally a lot of, loneliness and depression that comes along with the holidays when people don't have family or they're outside or they've lost connection, that social connection with people. Holidays are typically a sad kind of season. The cold, people generally will try to forget that they're outside and they'll use more or they'll use different substances, and then with the fentanyl crisis as well on top of it.
Some solutions to this problem have included a safer supply program and continued funding for safe consumption sites. The Alberta government, however, has rejected these, and the funding cuts to harm reduction services have alarmed harm reduction advocates such as LaRose. In Lethbridge, with their safe consumption site shutting down recently, there is a huge spike in overdoses. Though there is still a mobile consumption site, there is still a huge risk in overdose spikes and the need for a safer program to help those who need it. Allison McIntosh, a former harm reduction researcher for the Parkland Institute, advocates for a safer supply program during these times.
With a safe supply, basically, people know what they're getting, they know the quality, they know the dosage, and they can use it in a much safer manner. And from the other perspective, as policymakers, if there's a safe supply, that dries up the much demand for illegal drugs and for the harm created by a drug trade that, when drugs are considered to be illicit or illegal substances. By having a safe supply that is regulated, that is produced in known conditions, distributed through official channels, you have the potential to really reduce harm across a whole swath of issues that we face right now. And so I think it's absolutely essential that happens, and that our provincial government, which is in charge of so much health policy and so much allocation of health funding, recognizes that they need to check their ideology at the door.
For more on the story, look for opioid overdoses during COVID-19, leading to calls for a new approach to harm reduction. Lastly, we meet Gio Dolcicore, a counselor covered by reporter Nikita Leonard-Teal. Dolcicore identifies as non-binary and is one of the two non-binary counselors listed in Psychology Today's list of available counselors. Dolcicore discovering their gender identity has been a lifelong journey, starting all the way back in elementary. Recalling a memory where they were reprimanded for entering the wrong washroom, They said they weren't trying to be a bad person for doing that.
I grew up in the Catholic school system, so there was a lot of significant consequences that arose from a teacher finding me in the boys' bathroom. But legitimately, from that moment prior, I had no idea that that was not appropriate or wrong. And they called my parents. I remember my dad picked me up, brought me home, and my dad was just confused. Like, he just didn't understand. And I remember the next day when they dropped me off to the school, my mom was trying to explain to the principal that, you know, I just had to pee really bad. Like, I wasn't trying to be a bad person. And that I just, like, in the urgency of needing the bathroom, that's where I went. But I just was like, I saw my parents lying on my behalf to get me out of trouble that I didn't know, and no one really explained it to me. So for the longest part of my life after that, I just thought if I lied about how I felt expressing my gender, I could keep myself safe. And I just thought that was normal. That's what people did. You just lied about what felt good.
After that moment, Dolce Corey didn't question their gender again until college, when they joined a triathlon team and started working out. During that training, Dolce Corey said that they were trying to get as skinny as possible because that's what female athletes in the triathlete world do.
I just remember being, at the time, I thought it was being jealous or envious that the guys were bulking so quickly, and it was taking me so long to see myself put on some body mass or, you know.
At the time, Dolce Corey thought that they were a bad person for feeling that way. However, looking back at that moment, Dolce Corey believes that that jealousy came from wanting to, quote, change my body type or body presentation to be more masculine, as opposed to chasing these social constructs of feminine athletic success. After graduating from Mount Royal University with a Bachelor of Arts in Criminal Justice, they tried to become a police officer to serve the community. But there was a mentality that would eventually change Dolce Corey's mind about pursuing the field.
Back then, there was just this mentality that you molded yourself into this perfect image that CPS wanted you to be. And I was not that perfect image. I asked too many questions. I was more curious about what happened to people after we caught them. How are we going to help them? Most like, you would always hear me say, okay, so we restrained them, but how are we going to help them? That's not your job. I decided that I wanted to, like, help people in a different capacity. I wanted to help people be advocates, and I wanted to help people feel comfortable to be an activist. And I knew that those values were morals in my life.
Yeah.
So I wanted to pick a career that helped me encompass those values and those morals. And I looked at psychology and I looked at counseling programs, and they just didn't fit. And I looked at social work and I was like, yes, this is the one. Like, this is what I have to be.
At the University of Calgary, Dolce Corey met a transgender person who hadn't transitioned to a specific gender yet, but showed many non-binary characteristics. Through this interaction, Dolce Corey realized there's, quote, in-betweens they didn't know existed, motivating them to do more research, and was even the inspiration for a thesis focused on trans identities and figuring out the best practices to support people in deciding to either socially transition, medically transition, or both.
That's when I probably learned the most about my gender and how my gender is a combination of femininity from my past that I'm proud of. I'm not ashamed. Like, if you saw photos of me in college, I wouldn't flinch. I would kind of peacock a little bit and be like, yeah, like, I was a hardcore feminist, and those were, like, the beginning days of me finding confidence. And then if you know me now, I'm very masculine and very proud of that.
Dolce Corey explains that they demonstrate their non-binary identity by playing with the gender spectrum. Using this experience, Dolce Corey shares stories with others about how they can find their truth without being impacted by social constructs of how that's supposed to look.
Technically, I'm not supposed to look like any social construct that's actually out there. I don't fit the mold for anything. but that's what I'm most proud of. I love that I don't fit the mold.
For more on Dolce Corey's story, look for the headline, "This Counselor is Helping More 2S LGBTQ Plus People Become Therapists and Social Workers." This brings us to the end of the show, everyone. With all that being said, thank you so much for tuning in. All three stories I shared today are available both online and on the Calgary Journal's print edition for November and December, found at designated news stations across the city or by checking them out on the Calgary Journal website. Calgary Journal Recap was produced by Dean Cordero, with special thanks going to the Calgary Journal team and to Lee Rosevere for the music. Keep an eye out for more stories by checking out calgaryjournal.ca and by following us across our social media. Be safe out there, everyone. Keep an eye out for the next episode soon.